is a show where we deal with mental health issues each week from a more holistic perspective, which means finding a sense of balance between body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to stay in denial and avoid dealing with the very issues that could, if healed and understood, and patterns and behaviors change, could bring you into a place in your life that is more joyous and more peaceful and more productive so that you could succeed at what you want to do, or at least identify the things you want to do that you're not even aware of yet. So that's the focus of the show each week. And today, we're going to be talking about something that everyone can relate to, anger management. And I'm actually relating to it very personally right now. We all know that, I mean, everyone knows what anger is. Everybody has experienced it within themselves. Everybody has seen others who have gotten angry and maybe have could even be termed rageaholics, you know, people who are constantly getting angry and constantly being out of control. And maybe you even were raised in a household like that or grew up around somebody like that, whether it was a parent or a sibling or some relative or friend, where there was this constant fear of someone around you about to lose control. And think for a moment about what kind of life that was for you, or if you don't know somebody that actually was like that, what you think it might have been like, having to walk on eggshells, afraid of what somebody might, what you might say or do that might trigger it, having to repress who you are in order to deal with your own fear of triggering someone else's angry outburst. Now, my father was in no way a rageaholic or anything, but I was a pretty sensitive kid, and he didn't hit us or anything else. Well, my dad got mad and raised his voice. It was a bellow. And I would do almost anything to be the best boy that I could be just so that my dad would not yell at me. And like I said, it's not that my dad was abusive in any way, because he certainly wasn't. He was actually he was a great dad in a lot of ways. But his level of frustration sometimes spilled over, like parents do, and he just had one of those bellowing loud yells that just scared and intimidated me, and I would do anything to keep him from doing that, including hold everything in myself. Anger was something that scared me a lot, and yet I remember my whole life always being angry. Now, one of the things that I think is important, in my opinion, is that anger almost always disguises another emotion. It very often is a cover-up for what you're really feeling in terms of more vulnerable feelings like hurt, loss, powerless. And very often with a client who's dealing with a lot of anger, I'll have them close their eyes for a minute and try and visualize going beneath the anger, and very often they break into tears because there's a sadness, there's a vulnerability, there's a hurt, there's a fear that's going on. And very often people who are angry are trying to deflect you from actually seeing or getting in touch with another aspect of them that they're afraid that if you saw or experienced, they would be perceived as weak or vulnerable, and then they would be afraid that they would be attacked. So sometimes and many times, people who are in this constant state of anger or explosiveness are really trying to protect themselves as a defense. Now, that doesn't mean people don't legitimately get angry, and angry is a healthy and appropriate emotion. Very often, what's not healthy is when we repress it. What's not healthy is when we're withholding an honest and healthy expression of our anger, that we don't have the tool to be able to say, I feel angry right now at you, or something you did made me feel angry. And to be able to express it in the moment and move it instead of swallowing it down or being afraid you might hurt someone's feelings, if you're honest, remember the name of the show is Tell the Truth Faster. If you speak calmly and directly, or even not so commonly, that you're angry in the moment, you're not holding on to it anymore. It's not being thrown onto that pile of stuff that takes a lot of energy to hold in. Now, what happens with that from a holistic perspective is the body can hold on to that pile just so long before it starts breaking down. Either you start losing control or you start having physical ailments like headaches or, you know, ulcers, things like that. It has an impact when we repress it. So with all that being said, I want to introduce to you my guest today, who's also a really good friend and an incredible therapist and hypnotherapist. He is Dr. Jim Walton, who has a practice in Los Angeles and has done a lot of TV therapist consulting. And he is a really great guy and a good sense of humor. And Jim, I want to welcome you to the show for the second time. You were on the show over a year ago, I think.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, yeah, so how are you doing today?
It's nice being on your program again.
Thank you. With that set up in terms of what I talked about with anger, why did this become a focus of your practice? I know there's a number of things that you deal with, like stress and anxiety and depression, and you do a lot of couples work. Why did anger management become one of your specialties?
Well, one of the things I noticed in my patients is that oftentimes they weren't able to recognize the difference between feeling anger and acting out anger. And that seems to be a problem for people. Because oftentimes they feel if they're acting out the anger, they're expressing it clearly. And they're really not. Because when you act out anger, what you're doing is you're creating a charade for people to try to interpret what the anger means. For instance, if you start yelling at somebody, they start shutting down. They're not really hearing what you're saying, but they're reacting to the angry acting out that's going on. So the person who's expressing what they think is anger, they're really expressing something that creates fear in the other person, and they're not really clearly expressing their own needs. So what I have discovered is I try to help people be able to put it into words rather than the acting out. And acting out can be throwing things, hitting things, yelling, raising the voice. And by bringing awareness to being able to verbalize the feeling rather than acting it out, people have been able to settle their arguments more easily and feel more effective in their own lives.
Well, you mentioned something that I also said in my opening, that when people are outwardly out of control with their anger, it creates a level of intimidation in the people around them. So really what they're doing is creating a barrier and a wall and distance that is a protective device for many people.
Absolutely. One of the reasons people do the acting out of anger is it appears to work. The intimidation factor is in there. Another thing is it's more acceptable by society. If you watch television and movies, you'll see that the violence in movies, of course, is an expression of anger, and it gets reinforced over and over again as we're viewing these mediums. One of the things that's really important to stress to people is that they actually control their anger. Nobody makes them angry. They make themselves angry.
Talk more about that.
Well, when you express anger in a way that's unhealthy, through yelling, let's say, what happens is you get off center. And you feel in that moment that you're not in control of your own feelings. The other person out there or the situation that's happening, you're blaming that for your anger, so you feel out of control, and it feels like you don't have a center at that moment. And in reality, you really don't, because if you blame other people for your anger, they're the ones in control. If you were able to take it back, if you were able to center yourself and recognize that you yourself made you angry, you've made a choice, you then feel empowered. And in the sense of feeling empowered, you don't need to do as much acting out. You can pull it back in.
And I think the flip to that, Jim, is most people who are not willing to take an honest look at who they are and what they're doing are committed to not taking personal responsibility for their behaviors, their actions, and their life in general. In other words, if you have someone else to blame for your feelings, whether it's hurt or anger or whatever, then there's nothing you think you can do about it, and it's not your responsibility.
That's right. And if you feel it's not your responsibility, you're not going to take steps into improving your own life.
Right. And you're there trying to tell everyone else what's wrong with them and what they need to do to make your life better and so that you don't get angry anymore.
Absolutely.
And that's the trap a lot of abused spouses and, you know, kids who are growing up in households like that have. They end up feeling like it's all their fault, and if they just were better spouses or better kids, then mom or dad wouldn't get angry so much.
That's right. And they begin to take on guilt. And that does bring up the point that you brought up in the opening, and that is that anger very often is a front for other emotions,
mm-hmm.
like fear, pain, hurt, shame, guilt. And a child, if you start yelling at a child, one of the things you're doing is you're teaching the child first that acts of aggression are ways of settling differences.
Mm-hmm.
You're also modeling for that kid that acts of aggression are a way of expressing yourself. And you're putting into that kid a sense of guilt and shame and hurt and fear. And those are all the things that create a sense of anger in somebody. So it's no wonder that these kids go off and they begin to act out in angry ways, and they feel a sense of inner anger that just stays with them all the time.
Talk about a little bit more about the issue with children, because, you know, my feeling is that we see a lot of kids, you know, if you're out in a mall or something and there's this kid throwing a tantrum and stuff, you know, the kid knows how to control the parent if the parent allows that to continue. In other words, the kid's getting reinforced that if I throw a tantrum or if I'm angry, mom and dad will back down because their frustration level is just so hard and I'll get what I want ultimately. So what's that teaching a kid ultimately?
Well, that's teaching a kid, number one, that they can get away with the acting out behavior and that their environment is going to respond to it. So they learn that by throwing a tantrum, they can get what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes what happens is when people learn to throw tantrums, they amp themselves up with it.
And what does that mean?
Well, it means that in the current tantrum that they're throwing, they begin to exaggerate their behavior and they hold on to their anger longer, and they become less willing to let go of the anger. So you'll see a kid amp himself up with anger as he repeats it over and over in his head. And at the same time, what happens is that in future tantrums, they will be more... They feel like, okay, they can make it more effective by being more angry, and so they amp themselves up.
Or if they run into somebody where that tantrum's not working, they're going to amp it up to find a way to still get through to it because they have no other tools or techniques to express themselves other than the intimidation and the control that the anger and the rage brings.
That is correct.
So if just the tantrum's not going to work, then violence might work, and you know, unfortunately, we see teenagers that get into that or adults with road rage and things like that, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, because what's happening is in that moment, the child or the adult, for that matter, is raising something that they want into a demand, that they demand that something be their way rather than making it a request that it be their way. So by raising it to the level of a demand in a tantrum, they leave no options for themselves. They have no way of backing down without losing a sense of self. They invest themselves in the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And it increases. So when they're not making headway in their tantrum, the only thing they can do is push forward with more anger.
Now, mm-hmm. this is, to me, this plays out politically and globally, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is the basis of fundamentalist terrorists.
Yes.
And this is the basis of even Democrats against Republicans. If one thing doesn't work, if one scare tactic doesn't work, then they'll escalate. And if threatening to behead somebody doesn't work, then they'll behead them. And if beheading one person doesn't work, then they're going to escalate to more or find the bombs or, you know, it's part of the same, you know, out of control little kid that we see in politicians, we see in governments, we see in fundamentalist groups, and, you know, And we see people then reacting, trying to control them in ways that just antagonize them.
That's right. These groups just become magnifications of our own way of expressing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's raising requests into demands and expectations. And when we do that, we don't leave ourselves any options for negotiation.
With this, let's get back to a more personal level, because, I mean, when you started talking, all of a sudden, the whole global stuff started coming into me, and it's not necessarily the direction I wanted the show to go today. Actually, that's going to happen next week, which I'll tell the listeners about later. This type of behavior, the out-of-control anger, I mean, we know that it's more reinforced in men. It's okay for men. In our society, men are allowed to get angry, but they're not allowed to cry. Men are allowed to get angry, but they're not allowed to be vulnerable. I mean, traditionally, this has been the case. Of course, that's changed a lot, I think, in recent decades. But still, I think it's the norm, where women are not supposed to be allowed to be angry, but they can, in a sense, use tears and vulnerability to get what they want.
Well, in many ways, but not completely, women are allowed to express their emotions in a more healthy manner.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's perfect, but they do have more avenues for the expression of emotion. Men have been limited, basically, to being stoic or having outbursts of rage.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you're absolutely right, that's completely reinforced by society that it's okay behavior. But what's really happening is men are avoiding the healthy expression of their needs behind their anger, and the acting out of the anger is a way of getting people to avoid their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And it does come down to an avoidance of how we feel, and the fear of the expression of our vulnerability. Now, the real fact is that when we get angry, when we're off-center, we're more vulnerable than when we stay centered.
And we're more apt to do something totally inappropriate. I mean, the spontaneous fights that may happen or killings that may happen, or I mentioned road rage earlier. How much of this plays out when people get behind the wheel of a car?
Oh, well, that's just an extension of it when they're behind the wheel of a car. Again, they're feeling a sense of powerlessness. When we feel powerless in our lives, we have a tendency to want to act out in an angry action, and want to control the other person. And when we understand at that moment that we're not able to control that person, and angry behavior is a way of achieving that in our minds, we begin to act more aggressively on the road. And we also want to punish, you know, another thing that we want to do on the road with people is we want to punish that person, you know, who got in front of us or who cut us off or who didn't use a signal. And so we get invested in the idea of I'm going to teach that person a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to punish him. You know, if we just give up the idea of punishment, that will reduce our anger as well.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I said I always, in my practice and within my own life, it's kind of like when I get triggered that much by somebody on the road, you know, a simple question is, who am I really angry at? You know, who am I, who does this remind me of? To kind of detach from the inappropriate reaction of that moment to deal with the lifetime triggers that are there. So let's talk about the issue of triggers. And before we even get into that, I want to remind the callers that I know this is a trigger topic for a lot of people, and this is a live show. If you feel like calling in with a question for myself or Jim or make a comment about your own issues with anger, the number is 480-949-1310. That's in Phoenix, 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet from outside the Phoenix area, it's a toll call. It's the same number, 480-949-1310. So, Jim, let's talk about triggers.
Okay.
You know, it's like one way to raise someone's consciousness is to help them identify triggers that lead to certain behaviors. How do you work with that in your practice?
Okay, well, the first thing that I want to tell people in that situation is that anger is not a bad emotion either.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to create guilt for somebody
right.
if you feel angry. You know, the anger is useful. It lets us know that our boundaries have been crossed. It gives us a sense of rising energy that enables us to take some kind of action that we need to take care of our boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Once that takes place, once we recognize our boundaries are crossed and that we're feeling a sense of anger, we've gotten the message, and what we need to do then is to let go of it. So we have to resist that urge of holding on to anger when it's past its usefulness. And there's a strong urge, because, again, like we said earlier, that it's reinforced by society to hold on to anger. But anger is a healthy expression when we're able to verbalize what we're feeling. So some of the things that people can do about reducing their anger is they can first ask themselves, like when you were talking about driving on the road and somebody does something that makes you angry, one of the things I do is I ask myself, is this really going to matter 100 years from now? If so, okay, then I need to do something. But more than likely, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a cognitive way of being able to more easily release the anger and see the ridiculousness in my response. One of the things that I ask people to do to help them verbalize their feeling rather than act out is to describe to, if it's with another person that they have face-to-face contact with, describe what the offending behavior is to that person and express how you are feeling about that behavior. And then you can explain to them the effects that behavior has on you and then just ask them to do a different behavior. That is a way of expressing what you're feeling without being destructive about it.
Well, I think for someone who really has a problem with anger management, you're probably about 6 months to a year down the road in the therapy to get them to do that.
that's
to be able to maintain or to be that conscious and
right.
change the behavior that quickly. I totally agree with you. We're going to take a short break here, but when we come back, I'd like you to answer for the people listening how you start working with somebody who has an anger management problem to deal with the more acute outbursts initially.
Right.
So we're going to take a short break here, and this is Stuart Altshuler with Tell the Truth Fast. You're listening to KXAM in Phoenix, and we'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned. To tell the truth faster. We're all sure on the exam. And today's topic is anger management. My guest is a friend of mine who's a therapist in Los Angeles, Dr. Jim Walton. And Jim, before the break, you started talking about what people can do to start changing patterns and changing behaviors and changing their perception and thinking about things. First thing you talked about, I felt like was something that is maybe a few months down the line in therapy to be able to get that clear, to be able to just stop the impulse reaction and just be able to say to someone directly and, you know, assertively, I'm angry right now. But what about the initial steps? What do you tell somebody who's really out of control or really afraid of losing control to do when, you know, their patterns depict or are about to express the usual rage? What do they do initially?
Well, the first thing I tell somebody is never attempt to settle an argument when you're angry. Walk away from the situation, sit down, cool off, but tell the person you're coming back and you want to discuss it later. But first thing is just walk away. Cool yourself down. You know, what you want to do is you want to feel with your heart, but you want to act from your head.
Mm-hmm.
So when you walk off, when you're feeling angry, just walk away, find a place where you can sit down, and just take several deep breaths. And the best way of doing that is to inhale through your nose and just exhale through your mouth. And you can try counting backwards from 20 to 0. And that will give you enough distance, hopefully, between the incident and your response. Because you want to respond, you don't want to react.
Right.
And the first thing that you want to teach somebody, or that I like to teach somebody, is that they do have control of their responses. The first thing you can do is just walk away and calm yourself down.
It's kind of like a timeout.
It's a timeout, absolutely.
And when you're dealing, I know that I do this a lot with couples, when the arguments tend to escalate, you know, I actually have them create a contract and a specific agreement that one or both of them can say, look, this is going to escalate. We don't want that to happen. Let's take a break for a half an hour, with the agreement that we're not walking out on either one and that we will come back in half an hour or an hour, whatever they agree upon, and come back in a more centered place and talk it through and keep doing that agreement as often as they need to keep it from escalating into violence or rage.
Yes, that works.
And a lot of
well.
Couples I've worked with have really appreciated that kind of contract.
And what's very important about that contract is that when the person walks off, they state before they leave that they will be coming back and they agree on a particular time.
Exactly.
Because otherwise it feels to the other person that they're being abandoned.
And they're being disrespected.
Right.
In other words, how dare you walk away from me when I'm in the middle of this, when the person's intention may just be, if I don't walk away right now, it's going to get ugly and I don't want that to happen. So it's really by stating the agreement in that moment, it's respecting one another, and it's respecting the fact that I really do want to hear what you have to say, but in the state I'm in right now, boiling inside, I can't hear anything you're saying. I'm just in reaction.
That, you know, I like to call it back aggression.
Ah.
When someone turns around and walks away in the middle of an argument or a conversation.
It's also kind of passive-aggressive.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like you take control by not doing or saying anything, but just undermining the whole situation.
Exactly. So it's very important when you walk away to say, I would like to discuss this an hour from now.
Okay.
And then you stick to that.
So do you have the agreement that a timeout is appropriate? And while they're in that timeout, you mentioned about counting backwards from 20 and some calm breathing. You mentioned in through the nose slowly and out through the mouth slowly.
Yes.
You don't want a fast breath in and out because that's going to kind of accelerate the energy, and you want it to be a calming breath, correct?
You can actually count to 4 or 5.
For each inhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the exhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, the exhale can just be an exhale.
Okay.
The inhale is what's important.
Okay, good.
Inhaling to the count of 5.
Okay.
And then just exhaling it out. And you want to fill your lungs. You want to take it as a deep breath. And by the time you've done it for the third or fourth time, you'll find that your automatic responses are beginning to calm down.
Well, it's doing something else, I believe, also, because as you said, that you want to take a full breath. You want to expand the rib cage and fill your lungs, because in the midst of the anger and the rage, you're tensing. You're tightening up those muscles. Your chest is tightening and everything else. By doing the kind of breathing you're recommending, what you're doing also is stretching those muscles out so the tension physically is not feeding into the reactionary stuff, because the body-mind connection is one trigger causes another trigger emotionally, physically, psychologically, behaviorally. So what you're actually doing with the breath is allowing the muscles in the chest and the stomach to start relaxing and unwinding, which is sending another message to the mind and to the psyche that it's okay to calm down here.
Absolutely, because it's not supporting the anger reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The tightness and the tension and the short breath all contribute to pointing a person in the direction of anger. And what you're doing with a deep breath is you're doing the opposite.
Right.
And so the person begins to direct themselves in the opposite direction
mm-hmm.
of calming down. So you're right. It does send a message to the brain.
Right.
That, it's not the fight or flight response,
mm-hmm.
Which is the opposite. You know, it's like preparing the self. The adrenaline is flowing. When you take a deep breath and you start calming down, it pulls the adrenaline back too.
Now, what do you suggest to people who, once they do that timeout, and they're finding that actually does work,
yes.
but they don't necessarily have the communication skills yet to be able to come back and really start talking things through? They don't have the understanding or the insight or the confidence to actually verbalize what they need to say. Where do you go with those people?
Okay, one thing that I suggest to those people is before they actually come back and talk about their feelings, to go off somewhere and sit down quietly and ask themselves what's behind their anger.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, they can ask themselves, what am I afraid of? What am I hurt by?
Mm-hmm.
What am I ashamed of? What is my guilt?
Right.
And begin to take stock in what that is for the individual so they understand what is really behind their anger. Now, that's going to allow them to have more resources when they go back to talk about what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. One other tool that I find really useful, and I have people use this a lot, is if they're in that space and they're really afraid that they're going to get tongue-tied, is to actually take that time out and sit down and write. Maybe even a letter to that person. And if they're afraid that they're not going to remember everything or be able to express themselves clearly, they can come back and actually read what they wrote to the other person as a way of saying what needs to be said and a jump-off point for the conversation at that point.
That sounds like an excellent way of handling that,
mm-hmm.
the writing down.
Yeah, and also journaling. Like if it's not about a particular acute situation, if someone's dealing with this, that they, on a regular basis, maybe a daily basis at first, to actually sit down and keep an anger journal and write about their anger of the day as a way of releasing it, but also as a way of raising their consciousness and cognitive connection to the patterns that seem to be going on that they might not get if they didn't see it in black and white in front of them.
Yes, actually the journaling is very helpful when you look at the triggers.
Mm-hmm.
You would like to write down the situations that occurred just before the anger and then write down your responses.
Right.
And if you do that over the course of a week, you'll get a better understanding of what the triggers are for you and how you are responding to the world. And when you are aware of your behavior, you know, that which we're unaware of can control us. When you do the journaling, it's there on paper, it's with your own handwriting, and it's more, we're able to accept it a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can look at your own patterns.
Right.
And you begin to see that you do have control of your behavior because there's a pattern involved and you're the one that's enacting it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you have some other really useful tools because, you know, I've known you long enough, and I know that you're certified to do clinical hypnotherapy too.
Yes.
And I know that partially because you've done some of it with me over the years.
Yeah.
And you're the one in LA that when I need someone to refer to for something like this, you're the one I send them to. So talk a little bit about hypnosis and how it can be used in a situation like this.
Well, hypnosis is wonderful for using with anger. How you can use it. One of the best things about hypnosis is that it takes mind control to use it. So for someone to go into hypnosis, they have to be able to focus. And when you focus, you realize that you are in control of your thoughts. You're in control of your thinking, and you're in control of your actions. So when I do hypnosis for people with anger issues, one of the first things they experience is that they are in control. And they begin to allow their mind, they begin to control their thinking. And it's real important when you're angry to understand that you are in control of your thoughts. And the hypnosis allows them to relax into the situation. It gives them a sense of control of their thoughts. And by having a sense of control of your thoughts, you have a greater sense of control in your world. And when you're feeling more in control of your world, you are less angry.
Right.
And one of the things that I do with hypnosis underneath is give people an anchor. And an anchor can simply be being able to rub your fingers together. Oh, well, let me explain what that is.
Okay, good.
I just jumped a mile right there.
Yeah, okay.
An anchor is something where we create an association under hypnosis like rubbing your fingers, with a feeling of relaxation. So we create an association between relaxing and rubbing the fingers. And that's done by creating a scene, a very relaxing scene for the individual. And I have them rub their fingers in the moment of that scene, and we lock that image into the mind so that whenever they rub the fingers together, there's a strong association between the finger rubbing and that scene, and it becomes a very relaxing, calming experience for the individual. and it allows them once again to recognize that they are in control of their actions. They're in control of their thoughts. Nobody controls them.
Which is kind of, most people, and I think that's a safe thing to say, that most people have a misconception of hypnosis where they're thinking that, I think because of this theatrical hypnotist and stuff
right.
like that, that if they surrender themselves to hypnosis or to a hypnotherapist, that they're giving up control and that other hypnotherapist can have them do or say anything under hypnosis, and that a lot of people are a little frightened by hypnosis because of that.
That is so true, and it is just the opposite. Nobody can make you do anything under hypnosis. It's all self-generated.
Mm-hmm.
You are following the guidance of the person who's leading you through hypnosis, and you can choose to stop following that person at any time.
And you can choose to bring yourself out of the trance any time, too.
Absolutely.
Right.
All you do is you just focus on something else.
Mm-hmm.
And realistically, nobody can tell you to do anything under hypnosis that would be against your nature.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't really tell you to rob a bank at 1 o'clock.
Right.
If that's against your nature, because you'll simply wake up or you'll ignore the suggestion.
Right.
That's actually called ego dystonic. And ego dystonic means that it's something that goes against the nature of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
What we do with hypnosis is we create images that go along with the nature of the person. The person wants to feel more relaxed. The person wants to let go of their anger, and we work with that.
Mm-hmm. So that's when you have someone in the office. Now, I know, and I'm deliberately plugging this for you because I know that they're real good. You have a series of CDs or tapes that, and one of them is for anger management. How do the CDs work in terms of, since you don't have a hypnotherapist there, what's going on with the CDs that's helping someone deal with anger management problem before I tell them how they can get your CD?
Oh, great. Well, the CD is actually wonderful, and it's broken into three parts. The first part is a cognitive process on how to handle anger and how to deal with it, and it talks about how to do the writing and how to do separate the thoughts from the feelings. And the second part of the CD is an actual hypnosis for helping an individual to release the acute anger that they might be feeling at that moment, and giving them a sense of control of their thinking and understanding that they do control their thoughts and feelings, and putting in an automatic response for just kind of letting go of anger and being able to verbalize the feelings without the acting out. The third part is a daily meditation the individual can do just to help center themselves. So if they know they're going to go into a situation where they're going to possibly be triggered with anger, they can do the meditation and feel more empowered and more centered in the midst of that experience.
What's the feedback you've gotten from clients in terms of using the CD?
Oh, people, excellent. People have been telling me that it's really helped them a lot with their feelings of anger, and it's greatly reduced.
Now, you also have a CD on tension relief, sleep and stress, stop smoking.
Yep. Surviving the wedding.
Surviving the wedding. I like that one because, you know, I actually officiate weddings as an ordained minister, and the wedding survival thing is really important.
Yeah, that one actually tells people how. And what's really good in there, too, is because it does deal with some anger management issues.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, anger certainly comes up when people are planning weddings.
Absolutely. And, that CD is great for helping people learn how to communicate better when they're going through this whole ordeal of the wedding, and how to handle the pressures and how to handle the in-laws and how to handle the bachelor party. And, you know, it comes down to, again, taking personal responsibility for their actions.
Mm-hmm.
And reducing expectations, because one of the things that triggers anger is putting high expectations on others and feeling like those expectations aren't met. You know, the other thing is when people are continually angry with each other, their love begins to die.
Right. Now, what about someone's anger with themselves? I mean, we're talking about, most of what we've said today has to do with, you know, anger we have towards others who we perceive have wronged us or have abandoned us or whatever. But some of the anger that a lot of us feel actually is we're angry with ourselves.
Yeah, and that comes from a feeling of helplessness in our world again, where we're not taking responsibility for ourselves. When people feel, well, it can come from a couple areas. One is that if we were severely punished as children, and we start taking that in that there's something wrong with us, and we start accepting our parents' anger with us, and we start we integrate that, and we just start beating ourselves up whenever we feel helpless.
Mm-hmm.
That the way to work with that is to help the individual understand that that they are in control of their life, they can make the changes, that they're adopting a behavior that was modeled for them by a parent, and that it's not, they're punishing themselves with anger when they're angry at themselves, and punishment never works.
Mm-hmm.
Punishment doesn't work.
Well, if you have the belief that that's what you deserve, then it is working for you in an unhealthy way, because what you're doing is reinforcing the unhealthy negative beliefs, and then if you have that belief, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because you keep reinforcing it, which is exactly how the healing process takes place in what you say with the CDs that you have and with what we do in therapy, basically, is to help people identify what that negative programming is.
Right.
And basic Psych 101, which I say on the show all the time, how do you form behavior, how do you change behavior, is conditioning, repetition over time.
That's right.
Right? So
that's right.
Even your CDs, if somebody is listening to your CD on a daily basis, the repetition of that information coming in a relaxed state is allowing it to go deeper into the cellular core. And it also allows it to go in there without a lot of mental arguing against it.
That's absolutely right. In fact, in advertising, they say you have to see an ad 30 times within 30 days
mm-hmm.
for it to be effective. And it's the same as true in psychology. When we want to reprogram ourselves, it takes about 30 times for us to adopt another perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's repetitive. And the nice thing about the CD is it's a CD, and you can do that on a daily basis for 30
right.
days.
Well, the repetition, too, I mean, even plays that in politics. And, you know, I mean, in this day and age, I keep getting back to it because it's hard to separate, you know, the personal and the emotional stuff with what goes on in the political stuff. But, you know,
right.
the media people running the political campaigns know that whether something's true or not, if they say it often enough, people are going to start believing it.
That's absolutely true. You say something often enough, and people will accept it as truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form of brainwashing.
And exactly, even when facts have been stated to the opposite, you know, it's the sound bites. You hear them often enough, and you just assume that if you know, it's like the old thing: if you say anything with enough authority, people are going to believe you.
Well, you know, it's a form of hypnosis. When we watch television or we watch the movies. We are pulled into it. Our focus, remember, hypnosis is about focus, and we have to cooperate with it. And when we're watching television, we're cooperating with what's on TV, or we're cooperating with what's in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we go into a state of hypnosis. You know, that's why when you see a scary movie and somebody jumps out at someone on the screen, everybody screams and jumps in the movie theater, they're reacting to it as if it were real, but it's just really light on a screen. It's not real. It's not happening.
Right.
But we're in a state of hypnosis in that moment. Now, when we're in a state of hypnosis, we are receptive to what we're being told. So when you hear these sound bites on the news, you're already in a light state of hypnosis. You're becoming more receptive. You're not really analyzing what's being said as much. You are just taking in. So these sound bites that might not be true are going into the unconscious mind, and if you hear it enough, you begin to accept it
mm-hmm.
without being rational. You just begin to accept what's being said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the dangers of, actually, it's one of the dangers of music. We listen to music, it has a really catchy tune, but the words may not be healthy for us, or they may not be healthy for our world.
Mm-hmm.
But we go along, and the tune is great, and the tune is hypnotic.
Right.
So the words, we may not even listen to.
We may not even be able to understand them because the music is so loud, but it's kind of like that subliminal thing that's coming through. Because half the music and half the songs that you're listening to now, you know, unless you have the words in front of you to read, you don't, it's really hard to hear most of what's actually being said. But it's almost like a subliminal thing. You're hearing the music, you're hearing the loudness of it, you know, the bass pounding and everything else, but, you know, most of the words you can't even hear or understand, but you're getting it subliminally.
Absolutely, you're getting it subliminally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, music can be abused that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the artists that are creating that kind of negative music are really not aware of, probably aware of what they're doing and the effect that it's having on the person that's listening.
Well, some of them probably do.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but music can be, it can be very hypnotic.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be careful with what we're listening to, especially when we're driving, because you're doubly hypnotized. You know, you're driving, you're oftentimes thinking about dinner or whatever, and you've got the radio on, and you're listening to music, and the words are in the background, and it's feeding right into your head because your conscious mind is distracted from everything.
Mm-hmm.
The unconscious is wide awake and observing everything.
Well, actually, you know, this gives me a chance to kind of plug next week's show, because next week I have Constance Kaplan on, who's been on my show before also, who's a therapist. And the topic is how to think in an age of fanaticism. And basically, she spent her career studying psychodynamic concepts to contemporary social issues. And she warns of increasing parallels between a fanatic terrorist mindset and that of our own citizenry as we race towards the November election, which is exactly what we're talking about. You know, people are mindlessly listening and not really judging themselves. Like, I watched the Democratic Convention gavel to gavel. I use C-SPAN. I hate the inane commentary that we get on the networks and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I owed it to myself if I'm backing a certain candidate to hear everything I can hear and make my own judgments. And my intention is that I'm going to do the same thing with the Republican convention, so I can say that I've really listened and given it equal time. Because, you know, I may be a tried and true Democrat, but it doesn't mean I totally disagree with everything the Republicans say. It's
right.
Not a black and white thing.
Right.
You know, and I think it's very important that we keep ourselves open to the possibility that the other side may have some points and that there's a mid-place. And I call it, you know, that we're in a domestic Cold War. You know,
I like that. I think that's really very well put.
The international Cold War may have ended with or without Reagan's help, and, you know, that's a whole other story and from a past show that I did. But what that created is this domestic Cold War that we're in. Liberals against conservatives, you know, gays against straights, and, you know, Republicans against Democrats, and there's a Cold War going on in this country.
And once again, it leads back to anger.
Right.
And that it goes back to the acting out of anger rather than a dialogue.
Exactly. And that is actually why I went off on that tangent, because, you know, a number of times in the show today, we've gotten off into the global impact of anger management. This is not just an individual issue. This is not just a personal issue, but the healing of the global anger starts with the individuals taking personal responsibility for how they communicate and how they express their anger in the world.
Yes. If you look at each country, each country tends to have a personality
mm-hmm.
on its own, in the collective consciousness of those citizens of those particular countries create a personality for each one of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And on the global scale, they interact like children on a school playground.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to change the collective consciousness of a particular country, each individual has to take responsibility for the change of how they interact with their world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that totally. And, you know, that's a lot of what I teach. Even in you know, the metaphysics of the whole thing, the healing of the planet starts with the healing of the individual soul.
Yes, it does.
And by living in that healed individual soul, it has a cumulative effect. It has a ripple effect. Because when someone is in the presence of somebody who has that peaceful centeredness, they want it. There's an attraction to that light.
That is absolutely correct. And the thing is that when we're in the midst of our anger, we fill our heads with angry words, and we don't have any space at all to listen to our inner wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why that's why we're off center when we're angry, because we're not listening to our inner wisdom. And that's why it's so very important to be able to either do deep breathing or to meditate or to have a hypnosis experience where you can allow yourself to listen to that inner voice, giving yourself space to listen.
Right. Well, it's also, to me, I agree with you, the listening to our own inner voice is the ultimate goal of therapy, of whatever spiritual path we're on or whatever, you know, because to me, the essence of that inner voice, that, you know, soul voice, is not judgment and criticism. It's about oneness and sameness and connection with one another. But we're also in that angry defensive voice. We're also tuning out some possible important information that the other person may be giving us that may be right and realistic, but we're not willing to hear it at all. The same thing Democrats and Republicans are doing with each other also. I mean, Kerry, you know, is on this stop. I read in the paper today, you know, this train stop at night in Missouri, and couldn't even make a speech because the people that were there listening to him were being shouted down by the Bush people so much that it became a screaming match between the Kerry and the Bush people who were there to hear Kerry. Nobody was giving him a chance to make a statement. It was this tactic of just shouting him down. And so when you're doing that and you're in that mode and that kind of anger, you might not even be able to hear something that may be useful for you to get.
Right. We're not doing ourselves any favors by doing that.
Exactly. So we're nearing the end of the show. Is there any last thing? I know that people who want to reach you can do so in a number of ways. They can go to your website, which is latherapist.com.
Yes.
And they can get a lot of information. They can even get your CDs there.
Yes.
And find out more about them. But they can also go to hypnocd.com and get them on that website also by going and finding Dr. Walton's hypnocds.
So, I just want to make one more point, Stuart, and that is no one else is responsible for your anger but you.
Good closing statement. Jim, I want to thank you again for taking the time on your Saturday to be on the show, and I want to invite everybody to listen next week when I have Constance Kaplan on. This is Stuart Altshuler and Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
That I heard of one.